Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
It's hard enough to protect your personal online information while you are living. But what happens to the ghost in the machine when you're no longer around to do so? Does it matter? Chances are it does, right? I mean, given the way things work in cyberspace, you'll be delighted to know that we again have privacy expert Lance Cottrell with us to discuss that and perhaps a couple other intriguing cyber issues. To review briefly, Mr. Cottrell created Anonymizer in 1995, which was acquired by Abraxas in 2008, where he continues as chief scientist. You can find his excellent blog and podcast at theprivacyblog.com. Welcome back to the Social Network Show, Lance.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, welcome and thank you. We really appreciate you taking the time.
So what can you tell us about this question of getting our online persona to cease to exist at the same time we do? I know we have received messages reminding me that it's someone's birthday when I know that unfortunately their death day has already come and gone. It seems rather weird, but is that all there is to it? Just a little strangeness?
Well, I mean, certainly it is pretty creepy. You know, I've gotten those too. I've been congratulating them on some work anniversary or some other event like that. There are some real issues. A lot of these social media sites have not yet come up with real policies around what should happen to the data. You know, without any other sort of plans in place, your account will stay open forever, which of course means it's vulnerable to being hacked in the future. You're not there to moderate it. So if someone wants to come along and post something offensive to you or to your family, you don't have any ability to go in and edit that after the fact. Now, Facebook actually does have a way of dealing with this. You can fill out a form and send them a death certificate or other sort of formal notice, and they'll allow you to either delete the account or actually turn it into a memorial page where it's more restricted and people can't, sort of as freely post information to it.
Okay. Well, that would be helpful. Anybody else kind of working on handling this situation?
You know, it's really a mixed bag. Each one of the different sites have different policies. Some of them will automatically expire the account after some period of time, mm-hmm. 6 months or 9 months after you've become inactive on it. And of course, you can. Some of them will allow next of kin to take control of the account, which is its own sort of issue because you may be using that account, you know, in a very personal way. It may have a lot of information that you don't necessarily want your kids to be, you know, able to see. There are even websites now setting up that'll archive your passwords so that you can make sure that your next of kin can get access to it. But of course, that means you're giving some third party a list of all your usernames and passwords, which is, you know, yet another potential security pitfall.
Right. Falling into the wrong hands would be a real coup for a hacker, I would imagine. It sounds like that would probably be a prime target. Has anybody been doing that as far as archived passwords and usernames?
I haven't heard about any breaches of these services, but I think that at this point they're still so small and so little used that they're not that attractive a target just yet.
What is the generic term, in case someone wants to inquire of their sites that they're active on, what type of arrangement they have. I suppose you could just simply say, when I have died, but is there a term that in the field that's used for discontinuing that, or what is done with either the site or the information?
You know, I haven't seen real consistency in what these different websites describe it as, but there's a lot of different, you know, if you search for what happens to my social media account when I die, you'll actually find some really good resources on all the different services that are out there, you know, which different ISPs or social media rather will be able to take care of your stuff. So, for example, with Facebook, you need to be able to prove you're an immediate family member. Twitter wants you to have a death certificate. There's Pinterest, LinkedIn, Google. They all have their own rules, but probably deceased user would be a good phrase to type into their help pages.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I have a question. So here's a kind of a reverse of what we're used to talking about with you. So just curious, say you wanted to make an announcement and you wanted the widest possible readership, the most, just the widest reach, what would you do?
You know, probably if I wanted to get the word out, I would want to make sure that my immediate family had the username and password to my social media so they could log in as me, which technically probably violates the terms of service. But then they could actually go tweet, Facebook, whatever, the information out. And in my case, I'm fairly comfortable doing that because I don't use my social media account for anything that I'd be embarrassed about. So I'd be fine, say, leaving my wife and my parents, a sealed envelope with the credentials for getting into that.
Thank you. And what if you wanted a message out there while you're alive and you want to just basically reach a very wide audience? What would you do now? I mean, would you use, I'm just curious, with somebody with your knowledge, you want to make an announcement. It could be a book. It could be an event. What would you do now?
You know, that's kind of a classic, you know, PR problem. It really depends. If you've got a really large social media presence, you can just leverage that. How to develop a large following and a large audience that you can then reach out to is, sort of the $64,000 question. You know, lots of people are willing to sell you consulting around that, but it's hard.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for talking about that. There is another question I had in mind, and that is there seem to be more and more concerns lately about our own internet service providers, or ISPs, playing foul. What is going on in that realm, and can you first of all explain really who by names, for instance, or examples, are the ISPs versus the many other entities that we deal with?
Sure. So the ISP is the company, the organization that's providing you access to the internet at large. So it's that kind of first step onto the internet backbone. If you're at home, you probably have maybe a cable modem. You might have Comcast or Cox. Or you could have Verizon Fios or AT&T, any of those. And, of course, if you're on a cellular, that would be AT&T, Verizon, Cricket, and any of these. And in fact, Cricket's one that was just recently called out for some inappropriate behavior with their users' traffic.
What was going on?
Well, so some security researchers discovered that Cricket was modifying their network connections to mail servers and stripping out the encryption. So they had their mail client set up to, by default, do link encryption so that all of the messages to and from the mail server would be secure. And the way this works is your client, as soon as it opens the connection, sends a message that says, start encryption. It's called Start TLS. Mm-hmm. And the receiving end is supposed to then say, okay, you want encryption, and they handshake and set up the keys. The problem was that if you strip out just that request, then the receiving server thinks you don't want encryption. And unfortunately, if it just doesn't do anything about it, the client's kind of okay with that. And then suddenly and silently, you have an insecure connection that all of your emails flowing over.
Okay, now, so this is, I just have to be sure I understand this. This is if you're using your cell phone to send an email message. Is that correct?
That was the particular example here. And in fact, the guy was using the cellular data, but he was sending email from his laptop. So he had it tethered to the cellular network.
Okay.
For his data connection.
And you use the word client, and I'm so curious about this because it drives me up the wall. I think there's the normal everyday usage of the word client, someone that is paying you money for something, I guess. But in computer language, they're always referring to the client, and as if the computer has a client or the computer is a client. So how, can you disentangle that for me?
Sure. Right. Now, it's a somewhat confusing term. In general, when there's a communication on, there's a server, which is the device on the backbone of the internet. Typically, it's a big machine that's doing something for you. In this case, it would be handling your email. The client is the thing that you're running locally. So your copy of Outlook or your copy of Mail app or your browser, those are all clients.
Okay.
That are connecting to the servers at the other end. So when I'm talking about this, I'm saying, you know, your actual mail application, your copy of Outlook, is requesting the secure connection.
All right.
And it's not at all clear that Cricket was doing this maliciously.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence that they were intentionally sabotaging cryptography. It could have been a misconfigured firewall. There's actually many firewalls by default will strip that kind of encryption request out because it's catch-22 for businesses. On the one hand, they want security. On the other hand, if everything's encrypted end-to-end, they can't inspect it to see if there's bad things in the email like malware or company secrets or what have you.
Mm-hmm. So it gets rather complicated. And I would like to know more about that and also this thing called Dark Hotel and some other things that are going on lately that in the privacy sphere. So let's talk about that in our next segment. I'm Jane Karwoski with my co-host Jim Nico, and you're listening to The Social Network Show. Our guest is Lance Cottrell of theprivacyblog.com.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to www.ncpc.org. That's ncpc.org. This message brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, where Jim Nico and I are chatting with cyber privacy expert Lance Cottrell.
Okay, Lance, basically, is the scene out there on the internet for the regular person, maybe even the irregular person, is it getting more dangerous? Is it getting more difficult to protect your privacy, more complicated? Anything? Can you just comment on that for us, please?
Yeah, absolutely. The trend lines are not moving in a good direction for the average consumer. Obviously, social media itself has been a real complicating factor just because with people engaging in that way, there's so much more information available on the internet to be compromised than there used to be. And on the other hand, the attackers are getting much more sophisticated and much more active. So the number of breaches and the size of the breaches is getting larger, and it's gone from sort of being casual hackers and people trying to show what they can do to nation states, political activists, and large criminal organizations really dominating it. You know, and those people are doing it with a purpose and at scale.
Well, that's not the greatest of news, but I remember when we spoke once before, we were talking about privacy by design, and I believe that had to do with our discussion about the smart home and that there were very, very vulnerable points where that could be exploited in the smart home because of just not building in privacy. Now, has that had a good – is that just not happening when it comes to cell phones or computers or let alone the smart house?
Not nearly as much as you'd hope. Actually, cell phones turn out to be a bit of a bright spot in some ways because they're so restricted. You know, with a computer, you can install any software you want. You can configure it any way you want. But with phones, and especially the Apple devices, you're extremely limited in the kind of software you can install, the kind of things you can do. But the upside of that is so is the attacker, right? They can't just trick you into installing random software because you can't install random software. That's an example of where they've really taken a privacy and security first attitude. We're starting to see some startups in the social media space trying to differentiate themselves with their privacy policies and characteristics, but none of them have yet really gotten that viral explosion to become major players. So all the big players still were built without really any thought given to the privacy of the end users.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Apple, I followed the instructions you gave on your website about the threat to Apple, and I can't remember, what was the name of this last one?
Root pipe,
yes. And so it's simply a case of using an account that is not an administrator account, right?
Right. And that's really a good policy across the board, whether you're Mac or PC, is the account you're using every day should have the least possible privileges that still allows you to do your work. Because that means if something is compromised or someone can trick you into running something in that account, it can't do as much damage. If you're running as administrator, it has the potential to do a lot of things. Whereas if you're running in a very restricted account, it can't go and change system level things because it doesn't have permissions.
Okay. And as I recall, that simply involved going to your systems preference and users and groups. And if you don't have another alternate account, click add account and make that the admin and then go to your old one and make it not an admin or the other way around.
Right. Right. You always have to have at least one administrator account on the computer so that you can administer it. So, if your account, the one you usually use day in and day out, is an administrator account, you need to make sure that another admin account exists. If not, set it up and then use the other administrator account to remove administrator privileges from your usual account.
Okay. So you do that from the new one. To remove your admin from your usual account. Okay, well, yep. What, you know, one thing we've been hearing a little bit about is, and that one referred to root pipe, but what about dark hotel? What is that referring to?
The dark hotel is a new, what they call advanced persistent threat that was discovered. And it's a group of hackers that are specifically targeting executives and government officials staying in high-end hotels. So far, almost all of them have been in Asia, mostly in Japan. But they're automatically hacking into these people. And this is an example of where the attacks are becoming targeted. You know, a lot of viruses used to be just sort of out there and trying to infect everyone, which makes them easy to detect. But with dark hotel, they're laser targeting the individual people. In fact, these guys have hacked into the reservation systems at the hotels, so they know when the high, you know, the senior guy is going to check in. Mm-hmm. And then they set up the Wi-Fi, so it only hacks his computer. Because right? When you go into a hotel, you get that thing that pops up and says, type in your last name and your hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as you do, because they've hacked the Wi-Fi as well, they know who you are. They go, ah, you're the guy I want to go after. And it goes and hacks your computer and installs some malware, which then sits silent for a couple of months to make sure that the IT department doesn't notice it when you get home. And then it wakes up and doing all the action.
I'm sorry.
It's really hard for the security guys to catch.
Uh-huh. Because of the time lag and because only a one or isolated people are attacked.
Exactly right. You send your security guy to the hotel and he doesn't see any sign of hacking because the hack doesn't target him.
Uh-huh. Well, this is...
Damn, that's interesting. What's behind the scenes is just... It's amazing.
Now, the people who discover this, are they the so-called white hat hackers, people who are hackers but doing research to find out, to find the vulnerabilities?
Sure, you could call them that. It's the big security firms. I think this one was discovered by Kaspersky. And, you know, they've got their big antivirus labs. And all these security companies have big research departments. They're always trying to go out there and find these new kinds of attacks and to work out how to protect against them. And you know, eventually some companies noticed that these malwares were showing up. They brought in the company to try to track it back. But it looks like this group has been doing this kind of hacking in hotels for 7 years.
Whoa.
Before they got caught.
Wow, I knew there was somebody dark lurking in the hallway. Question, you know, we're going 40,000 miles an hour on a comet, but 300 million miles away. I'm wondering, is there some country that is the most advanced technologically when it comes to computers and technology in general, I guess?
You know, in terms of sort of the highest density of technical expertise at the highest level, it is probably the United States.
Okay.
You know, we're in Silicon Valley, that's such a huge concentration of the dot-coms, and mm-hmm. you know, really most of the best people in the world end up coming here because they get paid the best here.
Uh-huh.
So it's a real attractor for the mm-hmm. top talent. But that's not to say that, you know, other countries, India, China, Iran, do not have very large populations of very smart people, you know, who are fully capable of doing these things. And most of these tools and techniques get written about in the literature, you know, so you know, academics are writing about it. You see articles in security magazines, and these people are, you know, certainly capable of reading those articles and, you know, learning to apply these same techniques. So,
once
something's discovered, it spreads fast.
Uh-huh. There's been some concern about a service called Uber. And can you tell us about that, what it is and why it's making news?
Oh, yeah, there's quite a kerfuffle with Uber right now. And this really comes back to that social media information again. They've gotten caught in some cases tracking reporters and in one case actually talking about using tracking of reporters to dig up dirt on them because they have all the information about where everyone goes.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, internally, they have a mode called God View, which allows the employees in Uber to sit down and see where any customer is going, where every car is, and even look at it historically, so they can see every single trip everyone's taken. And, you know, they sort of have to have that information, but it's really very sensitive, and it could be used in lots of bad ways if people wanted to look up, you know, ex-girlfriends for stalking, or they want to track celebrities or what have you. It's kind of a lot of bad things that could go on.
Well, I think that illustrates how the idea that, well, if you have if nothing to hide, it doesn't matter, you know, your privacy isn't an issue, if, you know, well, why should you worry, you know? But the whole problem is giving that amount of information to any source, who's to say who's going to start using that source of information. You put that much powerful data in anybody's hands, you're putting a whole lot of trust and confidence in them that, frankly, I don't think anybody deserves.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And in this case, you know, there appears to be a bit of a culture of willingness to abuse this at Uber. But, you know, lots of other companies have similarly detailed information about you. And we just, you know, may not have had any of them dumb enough to sort of expose it publicly to reporters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and certainly you see the same thing even within the government, where a couple of years ago, the NSA was caught with their agents using the internal government databases to pull up information on, you know, ex-girlfriends, wife, lover, you know.
Yeah, the idea that
celebrities,
you know,
or whatever.
People are screened or above reproach is just absurd. You can just assume that it's going to be misused, in my opinion. Well, thank you so much, Lance. It's always interesting and fascinating and enlightening to talk with you. And we'll want to keep in touch with you. And of course, I urge our listeners to tune into your privacy blog, theprivacyblog.com, because you really keep up with the latest and the weirdest. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And we appreciate your being with us too, our listeners, and keeping us company today on the Social Network Show, where you hear commentary and analysis of our connected, networked world. And we hope to include practical advice from top business and marketing mentors, news from people combating cyberbullying and abuse, as well as experts such as Lance on privacy, surveillance, and, of course, our other area of emphasis, women and girls empowerment online. Please follow us on Twitter at Social Net Show, and Jim Nico also publishes regularly on LinkedIn, so you can follow him there. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us via questions at thesocialnetworkstation.com. Please have fun and be safe online and off until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.